Welcome to Real Money Radio, the show that focuses on real people, real problems, and real solutions. Here's your host, certified financial planner, David Holland.
Hi, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Glad to have you with us. And you know what? We're going to get inside your head today on the program. Well, not really. Well, maybe a little. I'm excited to talk with our guest today because we're going to get into a subject that has really been growing quite a bit in the world of finance. It's called behavioral economics. You're like, what in the world is that? Well, it has a lot to do with how we think about money and our financial decisions. And it's kind of a merging of psychology and finance. So I'm excited because Sarah Newcomb is our guest today. She's a PhD in behavioral economics. And so she's going to be helping us unwind and get inside our heads about money and finance and how we approach it. She is with Morningstar. She's a behavioral economist for Morningstar. In this role, she does a lot of work to integrate this whole subject into what Morningstar does. And also, she's working with advisors to have them understand this better and how to work with you, the investor. And so she's done this work. She's also written a book, which we'll get to in a minute. She's got a bachelor's degree in mathematics from Salem State University, master's degree in financial economics from University of Maine, and a master certification in personal finance from Bentley University. So just very tickled to have Sarah on the program. And the book, here we're going to talk about the book. It really puts a nice bow around this subject. Loaded is the name of the book. Loaded, Money, Psychology, and How to Get Ahead Without Leaving Your Values Behind. You can check it out at loadedbudget.com. Of course, the book is available at Amazon and other fine retailers. So let's get started. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
It is my pleasure, and I am wound up because I confess to Sarah, I envy her a little bit in the work that she's doing because this is a fascinating whole area, and I deal with it fairly often with people trying to get their heads on straight about money because as you have studied and have, I'm sure, seen and heard, sometimes we can be our own worst enemy when it comes to financial decisions we make.
Absolutely. I was my own worst enemy for the longest time, and which is what eventually drew me to the field.
And so you just had this moment where you're like, you know, I got to get my head on straight about this. And it kind of got you focused on it. And then you, of course, pursued all this education that you've really doubled down and got quite a bit in this one area. And it just kind of got you focused on it.
Well, sort of. I mean, what happened was that I had started college late because after growing up as one of four children in a very moderate income household, there was no money for me to go to college, and my parents wouldn't pay for loans, wouldn't co-sign for loans. So I had to take the route of waiting until my mid-20s when I was legally able to take loans out in my own name and went to school undeclared, ended up falling in love with math, and I graduated summa cum laude with a degree in mathematics, and I still couldn't get my finances together. And at that point, I had to admit that it had nothing to do with numbers because I'm really good with numbers.
If it was just numbers, you know, people could figure it out. But it's concepts, right?
It is. But interestingly, so then I buckled down, like you said. I realized, you know, I was a good student. So if I could understand the fundamental theorem of calculus, I must be able to figure out how to manage money. So at that point, I enrolled at Bentley University to be a personal financial planner. That was my plan, was learn how the pros do it. And so I went and I learned tax law and estate planning and portfolio management and asset allocation strategies. I learned all that stuff, but it still really didn't have the power to change my day-to-day decisions that were often self-sabotaging. So at that point, I realized it wasn't about numbers and it wasn't about knowledge either. There was something deeper going on. But there was one class, psychology in financial planning, and that was the class that really made the difference for me, because instead of talking about interest rates and investment strategies, we talked about class tension. We talked about how each one of us has a relationship with money that's largely inherited and unexamined. And I started to get at the roots of what was going on with me and money. And I found that there was a lot of fear and anger in my mind associated with money. And at that point, I realized I was never going to be able to really get a hold of my financial life until I dealt with the emotional issues that were underlying every single financial decision I was making.
Everybody's got a story, don't they? I mean, everybody's got a background, a history with money. You know, you introduce yourself and describing your, you know, delay to college because of your family's personal financial situation, and that made an imprint on how you view money, and it has followed you until you, you know, went through this, you know, catharsis process of figuring it out. And each person, I guess the question I'm thinking of, Sarah, is where do people start? I mean, you know, a lot of people are carrying around this financial or psychological financial baggage. Where do they start with getting their heads on straight about their money?
Yeah, well, so I think we have to start by understanding that every financial decision starts with a story that we're telling ourselves. Very little of money management actually has to do with the numbers. So much of it is about the story that we're telling ourselves because of those numbers. Because one number means one thing to you, it means something entirely different to somebody else. That's why you can have one family that's very comfortable on $50,000 a year, and another person that just feel very legitimately constrained on several million a year because of the stories that they're telling themselves about what they need and who they are. And for me, my story, I had associated money with barriers and inequality and greed and all the things that angered me about the world. And so with all of that in the way, I couldn't handle my money in a very efficient way because of the meanings, the social and cultural meanings that I had associated with it. So I think understanding that there's always a story underneath the behavior is the first step. And then if you want to understand what your story is, I suggest that people write it out, that they just tell the story of their financial life to themselves. Just write it down. What have your experience been? What was your first, when were you, did you first become aware of that big taboo word, class? When did you start noticing money in your life? And who has been your role models? And I like to say, you know, if you had to think about money as a character in your life story up to this point, has it been a friend or an enemy?
I think a lot of people, I know that's a bit rhetorical and for our listeners to think about themselves, but I think a lot of people are going to say it's an enemy.
Well, yes, or a lot of people will say, well, it's like a necessary evil.
Yeah.
You know, I love having money. I hate feeling stressed over money. I love having it. I don't like having to work at a job I don't enjoy in order to get it. All of those conflicting feelings about money are why I wrote this book, because I think that so many of the offerings of financial advice out there are written with the assumption that we all think money is great, that more is always better,
right,
and that we don't have any emotional hang-ups about that whatsoever. And I knew in my case that wasn't true. And once I started to pick apart my own financial story, I realized I couldn't be the only one. I couldn't be the only person who was smart and motivated and hardworking, but always felt out of control financially. And I thought I wanted to help people who were like me to get unstuck. So at that point, I decided to do a doctorate in psychology and economics and learn. I focused my dissertation on the psychological barriers to sound money management. I wanted to know what are the ways that we as people get in our own way financially, and how can we then start to straighten those things out and overcome them.
Good stuff, Sarah. I'm so glad you're with us, and we'll be digging more into this in just a second. We're going to grab a quick break. When we come back, Sarah Newcomb is going to rejoin us, and she's a behavioral economist over at Morningstar. The book is Loaded, Money, Psychology, and How to Get Ahead Without Leaving Your Values Behind. Lots of good stuff over at Morningstar.com, and of course, more about the book, LoadedBudget.com. Quick break, right back with Sarah.
The Rice and Rose Law Firm is celebrating 30 years of service in Volusia and Flagler counties. I'm Paul Rice, and I'm board certified in divorce and family law. I specialize in representing divorcing spouses over the age of 50. Spouses getting divorced in their 50s, 60s, and 70s confront far different challenges than younger people. If you have questions about alimony, division of retirement or investment accounts, Social Security, health insurance, or anything else, you can contact me in our Daytona Beach office at 257-1222 or visit my website at ricerosenlaw.com.
When it comes to finding a financial advisor you can trust, do you know the right questions to ask? David Holland has written a popular book that can help, and it's called How to Get Great Advice and Avoid Scams. David has crammed his experience and insider knowledge about advisors and how they operate into this popular book. Visit Amazon.com to order your copy. Or if you want to meet one-on-one with David to talk about your financial goals and concerns, he'll give you a free copy of his book with no cost, no obligation. The number to call for your appointment with David is 671-PLAN. That's 671-PLAN. Or visit PlanStronger.com.
And welcome back. Sarah Newcomb on the line, PhD, and she has written the book Loaded: Money Psychology and How to Get Ahead Without Leaving Your Values Behind. Morningstar.com, that's where she works, and there's a lot of good information over there. And, of course, the website for the book, loadedbudget.com. Sarah, I got to ask the question, speaking of loaded budget, I got to ask the question that a lot of listeners I know can relate to. Why is budgeting so hard?
It's a great question. I think it's because, and I really dig into this in the book, I think that it's because of the typical budgeting advice, which goes something like this. You have to know the difference between a want and a need. We've all heard that before, right?
Sure,
and it
sure.
seems so fundamentally true that we never challenge it. But I challenge it, and this is why. When you tell yourself you need to know the difference between a want and a need, the underlying message there is that if you don't need it for survival, you don't need it. It basically says that our emotional needs and our higher order needs are not allowed in our budget.
Right.
And so when we budget from that perspective, a budget is basically a plan for how we are going to feel deprived.
Right.
So
that is so true.
We need to find a better way. Budgeting should not feel like a diet, but it almost always does.
Yeah.
And so the way that I flip that is to say, look, we don't need to know the difference between a want and a need. We need to know the difference between a need and a strategy for meeting that need. So our fundamental human need for joy and fun and excitement and friendship and all those things that make life meaningful and worthwhile and help us feel satisfied, those are real, legitimate human needs. The strategies that we use and the financial strategies that we use to meet those needs are flexible. So if let's talk about the typical, you could save a gazillion dollars if you didn't go to the coffee shop every afternoon, right?
Right?
Or
that's
every morning.
Right.
And we all say, oh, it makes so much sense. I'll just brew my coffee at home, or I'll just drink my coffee in the office. And anybody that has tried this for a couple of days and failed understands that the need that they're meeting by going to the coffee shop is not for caffeine. Because if that were the need, they could replace that and it wouldn't feel like any kind of loss.
Right.
But there are greater needs, other different needs that people meet when they go. Maybe the only thing that gets them out of bed is that thought of the smell of the cafe and the music and the busyness of people. Or maybe in the middle of the afternoon, it's breaking the monotony at work, or it's taking a walk in the city or in the sunshine. Whatever it is, if they're meeting their needs for joy or for social connection or for beauty or for a little bit of entertainment, those needs don't go away when you cut that expense out of your budget. The expense goes away, but the need stays there, only now it's not getting satisfied. So it gets louder and louder until you feel uncomfortable enough that you find some way to meet it. So what I think people need to learn to do is anytime you want to cut an expense from your budget, rather than just cutting the expense and saying, well, now the numbers work, even though I don't feel happy, you say, okay, what was this expense meeting? What are the deep human needs that I'm meeting with this expense, whether it's your gym membership or your car payment or anything? What are the human needs that you're meeting? And then you can look for an alternate strategy to meet those same needs while spending less money.
Well, it makes sense to me. It makes sense, I'm sure, to people listening. You've got to unwind it and understand what's really going on with whatever that expense is or that expenditure. And, you know, I kind of thought of a funny way of looking at it as you were describing it, Sarah, that, you know, about differentiating wants from needs. It's, you know, somebody else might want that television, but I really need it. You know, and so it's
right.
All perspective, right?
Right. Well, so there's a great way to kind of understand, you know, the difference between a want and a need. And this comes from the work of Dr. Marshall Rosenberg, who I really admire. So the late Dr. Rosenberg talks about wants and needs in this way. And he says, look, everything that we do is a strategy to meet a fundamental human need. Mm. Some of our strategies are terrible and they don't work, or they're even counter to the results that we really want. But everything we do is an attempt to meet a fundamental human need. So to get to that fundamental level, a great rule of thumb is to ask yourself, well, can everybody have this at the same time? And if not, then it's a strategy. Mm. Once you get to that thing that everybody can have, then you're at the level of need. So everyone needs transportation.
Right.
Right? But a car, a train, a bus, walking, a bike, all of those are different forms of transportation. Each one has a very different price tag associated with it. So there's a need, and then there's the strategy to meet the need. So entertainment, fun, comfort, relaxation, diversion, joy, all those needs that your television needs, that one TV, that one particular model, that one home theater setup is one strategy to meet that need. And when you really get to the need, then you can start to find strategies that you actually feel excited about. And that's the thing, is that then rather than the budget being this diet or a plan for how you're going to starve yourself of joy, it's really a map of how you're going to get from how you're going to take your available resources and use them to meet all of your needs so that you feel fully satisfied. And by the way, your need for security and peace of mind that comes through saving and having a rainy day fund and knowing that you won't be a burden on your children in your old age, those are needs too. So we have to find strategies to meet all of our needs without sabotaging our other needs.
I really like that, Sarah. That's a good way for people to look at these budget line items as they go through and think about where they spend their money, and they connect them to, as you describe, meeting a need, these intrinsic human needs, and to think, you know, kind of rethink or recast their view of this, and then it allows them. And I guess that, you know, on the other part of it is maybe a little bit like looking like you're connecting dots, is you've got your budget on the, maybe the left side of the paper and, you know, all this number stuff. And then on the right side, maybe you write down some of the things that are really important to you. And you then you think about how you use the left side, the budget part, to meet those needs.
Yeah, and actually so if you think of your income and expenses, the typical budget that we think of where income is on the left-hand side and expenses are on the right, or whichever way you do it, right? And you subtract your expenses from your income, and whatever's left over is your savings, or it's actually your change in net worth for that period of time, which is, to me, a nice motivator to keep that number as large as possible. So we talked about how expenses map needs, but on the income side of your budget, every stream of income is actually being generated by an asset. If the income is a stream, there has to be an asset, there has to be a spring that's generating that value. So when you think about your paycheck and your salary, the asset that's generating that is not the company that you work for. The asset is your time, your energy, your intelligence, your experience, your network, your personal genius being put to work. Your company is renting that from you.
Yeah.
And so the asset that you have in your labor, there's only three types of assets: land, labor, and capital. And if you ever want to stop laboring, you have to have land and or capital to replace the income stream from your labor. So when you start thinking in those ways and start assessing, rather than your streams of income, you start to look at, what are my assets? What do I have that's of value to the people around me? Land, labor, and capital. And each one of those things is actually just resources that have been put to use. So we all have resources. We don't all start with assets, but we all have resources, time, energy, intelligence at the very least. And we can combine those to create labor. And then we rent out our labor. We rent that asset out. And so when you think of it in that way, your money is coming from you. It's coming from your resources being created into marketable assets that generate income streams. And so income and expenses is like, I think of it rather than on the left side of the page, I put it in the middle of the page.
Yeah.
But each side maps out to something bigger. The income and expenses part of your budget, that's the how money is moving in your life. But your resources and needs, that's economics. Economics is always and will ever be about how we take our resources and channel them to meet our needs. And in that way, your money, rather than coming into your life in the form of income and then going back out in the form of expenses, which is a really powerless way to think about your money, but that's what the cash flow model of budgeting teaches us. Rather than thinking about that, I encourage people to think of their lives as a personal economy. Mm. We have resources, and we channel those resources to meet our needs. Our money comes from us, and it goes to us. And
good
in that
stuff.
Way, it brings that sense of control inward, and it becomes this creative act. Rather, and budgeting is actually a fun and creative exercise of how am I going to map all my resources to meet my needs in a way that I feel really satisfied.
And that really is the heart of it. And that you said it so well there, Sarah. That's really the heart, is how you're mapping these resources to meet your needs and those of your family and other goals you have. Sarah Newcomb is our guest today, ladies and gentlemen, PhD in behavioral economics. She's a behavioral economist over at Morningstar. She's written the book Loaded, Money Psychology and How to Get Ahead Without Leaving Your Values Behind. We'll grab a quick break and come right back with Sarah and dig a little deeper. I want to ask about class and how that affects our way of viewing money. Stay right there.
Two things are for sure. It's summertime and the kids want to swim. I'm sure glad that we enrolled our children in the Volusia Flagler YMCA Summer Swim Program. It was so easy. At the Y, they enjoy water sports, meet new friends, and most important, they learn water safety skills. If you haven't signed up yet, call your local Y or log on to vfymca.org. Come on, it's summertime. Enjoy it more with the summer swim programs from your Volusia Flagler YMCA.
Hi, I'm Dr. Dan Drake. My staff and I have enjoyed delivering excellent, lasting dental care to countless patients for many years. We are a modern dental practice offering a full range of services, including cosmetic, implant, Invisalign, and general dentistry. Additionally, I am one of only a few dentists licensed to perform IV sedation, sleep dentistry to help those of you who are anxious. My belief and commitment is to deliver outstanding dental care and positive patient experiences. We look forward to serving you. If you have a dental question or concern, don't hesitate to call us at 386-673-1611 or visit AtlanticDentists.com.
Hi, this is David Holland. I've been going to Dr. Drake's office for over 20 years. I trust them, and you can too.
Hi, this is Mike Peerless, NMLS number 1073735, Reverse Mortgage Director for Holland Mortgage Services, a subsidiary of Holland Financial. It used to be that people considered a reverse mortgage as a loan of last resort. In fact, our company's founder and host of this program, David Holland, was a skeptic himself. However, after many client requests, David investigated this product thoroughly and decided that a reverse mortgage could fit into one's overall financial plan. Holland Mortgage Services is a licensed Florida broker, and we can help you refinance your existing mortgage and stop making ongoing monthly mortgage payments. However, you're still responsible for payment of property taxes, homeowners insurance, and HOA fees. You can also tap your home's equity to pay off credit cards or put cash in the bank. Call 386-671-7526 today for a free evaluation. Sometimes, to move forward, you need to go reverse. That number again is 386-671-7526. Holland Mortgage Services, NMLS number 1432962.
Hi there, welcome back. Sarah Newcomb on the line with us, our behavioral economist. She's written the book Loaded, Money, Psychology, and How to Get Ahead Without Leaving Your Values Behind. Sarah, you know, before the break and earlier in our interview, I heard the word class come up a couple of times and our view of that. And I'd love to take the last couple of minutes we have together to kind of talk about that. And it sounds like it has to do with, you know, how we view the different classes of society and maybe our own perspective on who has money, who doesn't, and how that affects us. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Sure. The forbidden word. You know, even as I was writing this book, my editors kept telling me not to use the word class.
Really?
And I said, okay, I'll minimize my use of the word as long as you recognize the irony of asking me about this in this particular book. Because class was really, it's one of the last taboos of conversation. Mm. We are not allowed to talk about it openly. I mean, money itself, discussing money in any fine detail is very impolite conversation. but class is even worse. And I think that we are all very attuned to it, but in our social lives, but
yeah.
It's not called socioeconomic status for nothing. You know, there's a social part to class, and I think we'd be hard pressed, most of us, to live our lives without experiencing it.
That's interesting.
Either being rejected or judged or admired because of our class. And I think, you know, we really just need to be aware. So much of this is just about being as mindful and putting as much depth of thought into our financial thoughts as we do other areas of our life.
But it affects how we view our money and how what we do with our money and how we deploy our resources. And that's why it's just so important to be mindful of it. And I think it's interesting, Sarah, put that the subject of class is taboo. I mean, you know, people will talk about politics, religions, all kinds of other subjects, which are already supposed to be on the do not talk about list before they get into money or even social status and class, because it really is. I mean, it's so tied up with people's perception of others and their own self-worth or place mm-hmm. in society that it's like, don't go there.
Yeah, we have some sort of equation in our minds where net worth equals self-worth. And I can't say that our consumer society helps that very much, but it's something that we each need to really ask ourselves, how much we believe in that equation and how much we believe or how much we subject other people to that equation. And so I think in particular, it can be very difficult when you're on the extreme end, either
yeah.
on the extreme low income, where you can, as I did as a child, really limit your view of what you're able to do in the world, because evidence tells you that you will not be able to make it. There are poverty traps in our country where neighborhoods, where if you're born there, you are not getting out.
Mm.
And it's not because you're not trying. It's because there are so many forces working against you in that area. And then if you're on the higher end, I spoke to an executive recently who said his 16-year-old daughter came to him one day and said, "Dad, are we in the 1%? That means
yeah.
we're bad."
How about that?
And so here she is starting
yeah.
to incorporate her privilege and her wealth as something that she's feeling guilty about. And that's going to affect how she handles money, how she handles the legacy that's handed down to her from her parents. So
well,
I think we have to really check how poverty and privilege are affecting our self-perception.
Well, it sounds to me like she needs your book, Sarah. We'll get her a copy, Loaded Money, Psychology, and How to Get Ahead Without Leaving Your Values Behind. Sarah Newcomb is our guest today, ladies and gentlemen. Sarah, great interview. Thanks for being with us, and we'll definitely check in with you again and have you back. Thanks for your time.
Great. Thank you so much.
Today's edition of Real Money Radio has been brought to you by Holland Financial, conveniently located on Granada Boulevard in Ormond Beach. Could you benefit from a one-on-one confidential conversation with David Holland, or would you like a second opinion to make sure that you're on the right track? Call Holland Financial at 671-PLAN or visit us at planstronger.com to schedule your no-obligation consultation. David looks forward to discussing the financial issues that matter most to you. The host of Real Money Radio, David Holland, is a certified financial planner with over 20 years of experience. And because David provides advice to clients on a daily basis, his hyperactive compliance department wants us to tell you that David Holland is an investment advisor representative of Holland Advisory Services, a registered investment advisory firm. He offers insurance and annuity products through Holland Insurance Services. Commentary given during this radio program should not be considered investment, insurance, tax, or legal advice. Views expressed concerning specific securities are not an offer to buy or sell. Investment advice and planning services can only be given after an analysis of an individual situation and only where Holland Advisory Services is registered or exempt from registering. Real Money Radio is produced by Holland Productions.